On April the 18th, World Heritage Day, Dame Fiona Reynolds, the chair of INTU, gave this inspiring speech.
We're in the aftermath of Easter, and so it seems a very good time to be talking about the wonders of our World Heritage on today, World Heritage Day. So I'm going to begin with a topical question about what we all like to do when we're on holiday, because if you're anything like me, I go straight for the things that feel special about the place that I'm in, the scenery, the architecture, a chance to sort of look behind the kind of tourist screen and find what's really special and distinctive and unusual about a place. What makes it tick? And I don't know, again, if you're the same as me, but if I'm going abroader, I head for the local markets. I like to feel that we're kind of steeped in the local culture, try out however poor our local language skills are, find the places, the bars, the restaurants, the cafes where the locals go and not the tourists. You know, really try to find that unique and distinctive feel about a place. And we love it when we come across something that we feel that no one else has discovered, perhaps a local festival or a local custom. Seek out the real souvenirs, you know, the ones that feel as if they really belong to the place, reflecting local skills and traditions. And actually, I don't think I am alone in all of that, because one of the main reasons for tourism today is people seeking out world's traditions and cultures. It's one of the main reasons that we travel for leisure. We want to see the world. We want to see the world as authentically and as kind of personally as we can. And people love to see the traditions, whether of performing arts or traditions, handicrafts, rituals, customs, the things that make you feel as if you've really touched the spirit of a place. So that's what we're talking about today. It's what we call intangible heritage, the things that belong to a place and to its people, the highly distinctive cultural expressions that pass from one generation to another, that have evolved very much in response to the environment and the special conditions of a place, and what give us and give a place a sense of identity and continuity. And I think on World Heritage Day, it's really pertinent to talk about this. It's something we all delight in and we all enjoy. Yet it's also clear that it's under threat, perhaps as never before. And why is it under threat? Well, it's obvious, isn't it, in many ways. The forces of globalization, of cultural homogenization, all the pressures for economic development and social progress, all things that, you know, we understand and, in a sense, our cultures have all been through. But the risk is, of course, that those processes leave in their wake a world that is poorer in culture and which has wiped away the traces of history and local distinctiveness. Because the threats are real. According to National Geographic, one language dies every 14 days. It's a shocking statistic. And that force of globalization, you can see in practice, any of us who watch the news, who kind of follow these things, can see communities living whether in Africa, South America, people who have abandoned their native languages in favor of either English, which is increasingly a global language, but so too Spanish or French or others, as Western so-called civilization has swept across the world. And of course, we have the same technology. Even our children have got the same technology. All of them have got now mobile phones, access to the same social media. And of course, that brings benefits of connection, of communication. But it also affects, however deeply, domestic and homegrown culture, and can lead to radical changes in behaviour and thinking. Indeed, it's clear that minority ethnic communities confine themselves where their very existence is threatened and where their language, culture and tradition is at risk of disappearing, never been properly recorded, let alone promoted. Mobility is another factor. We all live in this incredibly mobile world. We're no longer, any of us, confined to the place where we were born, We don't live our lives any longer with people who are all native to that area. In fact, and again, there are many benefits to this, we're exposed to people from many different cultures and experiences, and we're able to, if you like, pick a mix from those experiences to learn new ways of speaking or dressing, new ideas about values, about lifestyles of any of the groups that we come across. And migration itself, whether long-term stable migration or the forces that we're seeing around the world, have contributed enormously to the richness and diversity of cultures in developed nations. But so too can migration cause a loss of cultural identity, a sense of cultural bereavement for people who perhaps have been displaced or who feel that they've lost something vital about their own lives and backgrounds. And although this can be something we can talk about in terms of the national news and the politics and kind of the future of the globe, it's also clear that heritage and understanding heritage can help us find a voice for these concerns and help us to explore them. This, for example, is the... The Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York. A place, if you haven't visited, I urge you to go. It's a fantastic old tenement building that's been redeveloped in order to speak of the different experiences of the enormous variety of cultural migrants who came in through Ellis Island, particularly in the 19th century, into New York. But they aren't content just with showing us what it was like to come in and live in the tenement museum. This is one of the interlocutors who brings, alongside our historical programming, a really challenging debate about present-day immigration to the United States, something which, of course, is even more politically contentious as the years go by. And this is playing a really important role in these unsettled times, bringing people together to talk about migration and what it means culturally, economically, socially for the community. Now, of course, the forces of globalization, the influence of market economies, make societies more outward-looking. We share a greater sense of understanding, often makes people materially better off, giving individuals opportunities that their predecessors could scarcely have dreamt of. But that process of civilization does also have its critics and its challenges. One very famous critic of civilization was William Morris, the great aesthete, who railed against the pace of change in the industrializing world. And he famously said, "Apart from the desire to produce beautiful things, the leading passion of my life has been and is a hatred of modern civilization." Now, not many of us will put it quite so strongly today, I suspect. But in truth, ours is a shrinking world, and we are all faced with a rapid pace of change, which can be frightening as well as enabling. Now, of course, it's not for us to stand in the way of progress, but I think it is right to question whether progress is always as beneficial for everybody. Because if the cost of that progress is that we lose the very essence of what makes a place and society function, including the loss of memory and ritual. This is Angkor Wat in Cambodia, a place of great ritual, culture, language, music, poetry, and costume. Now, are we prepared to see those traditions go without a backward glance? Because intangible cultural heritage relies on communities to survive. And I mean real communities, not virtual communities. Communities who live together, work together, practice these rituals, learn and share, and ensure that they're passed on to future generations. These are the things that intangible cultural heritage now is seeing at risk. But before we get too gloomy, I think we should also realise that cultural heritage can be incredibly resilient. And one of the reasons for that is, as I said, people love heritage, both tangible and intangible. I talked earlier about what we feel like as tourists, and around the world today, there are millions of tourists visiting heritage sites, helping to keep them viable and open for the future. World Heritage Sites, which perhaps today are the focal point of World Heritage Day, are, as Catherine said, there are over 1,000 of the most significant and important places on Earth, with literally millions of visitors each year. 90 of those have over 1 million visits a year. And Beijing, the Forbidden City, has 15 million visits a year. These are incredibly popular places. But of course, these sites, World Heritage Sites, they are critically important, but they have much, much better protection than the smaller sites and the intangible heritage that I'm talking about today. Because, of course, our heritage is not only about the monumental, the defined, the protected formal heritage. It is about the little things, the things that characterise a place and its people. And in some ways, the intangible heritage can be even more powerful than the tangible. Stone can crumble, wood can rot, but ideas, beliefs, concepts, legends, stories can go on forever. But only if we care about them, and only if we want them to stay alive. And in a world where too often it's only the material and the tangible that get any traction, it's getting harder to provide the space and the value for the things that matter but money can't buy. And that includes our intangible cultural heritage. Yet, we would argue that the conservation of intangible heritage is not a fringe activity. It's an absolute necessity if, in fact, we're going to have a world worth living in for the future. But it needs different skills, different techniques than those that we use for the tangible heritage. Above all, it needs to be kept alive and relevant. It is about people and communities learning and living and sharing between generations and between each other. And so I'm very proud to say that the National Trusts of the world are at the forefront of safeguarding our cultural heritage, helping to keep alive the simple pleasures, the cultures and the traditions that are passed on from generation to generation. And that's not just in far-flung places of the world distant from here, although this place is pretty distant, St Kilda, I have to say. It's about as distant as you can get in the British Isles. But this is a lovely story of intangible heritage. This is the Mistress Stone, the little sort of keyhole there on St Kilda, where young men had to establish their climbing prowess before getting married. They had to perch on that stone before their wedding to prove, I suppose, their virility or some such thing. And St Kilda is a place, you know, full of heritage, full of stories, but actually it's the intangible stories, those stories of a community and a culture that are just as important as the tangible ones. Now, INTO, the organisation that Catherine leads, is an organisation which brings together a global family of national trusts around the world to speak for conservation and with one voice on issues of common concern. And we do that through partly through conferences, and many of you were at this wonderful conference, which is now coming up to 2 years ago, hard to believe. This is us meeting in Cambridge in 2015. And one of the things we most value doing is coming together as a family of organisations who share common values to help each other wherever we are in the world, and also to establish national trusts in countries that don't currently have one. Now, every national trust is different. Some own property, others don't. Some are large, some are small, some have been in existence for a very long time, and some are very, very new. But all of us share a passion for heritage in all its forms and are passionate about conserving it for future generations. And so in many ways, although you might think that heritage is our common thread, it's people who are our common thread. Because what we're doing for people, for this generation and for future generations. And together, we hold what might be described in a way as cultural memory of our countries. Heritage both tangible and intangible. This is one of the working groups from Cambridge, visiting Anglesey Abbey, people sharing ideas, thinking about what inspires people to appreciate, enjoy, and be motivated to protect our heritage. So by working together, we provide a great source of cultural interaction, and we're committed to building dialogue and tolerance through education and outreach programs, civic engagement, volunteering, fundraising, and membership. The conference before Cambridge was in Entebbe in Africa, and this was a real focus, understandably perhaps, on the need for special measures to promote and protect intangible heritage, especially within the least economically developed nations of our world. Now, intangible heritage is not something we've just dreamt up. It's the subject of its own UNESCO convention, dating from 2003. And that convention recognises that intangible heritage is a precious commodity that needs nurturing and protecting just as much as the physical heritage of places, buildings, and landscapes. But you know what? The UK government still has not ratified that convention, despite many, many other countries throughout the world doing so. So one of the things today that we're calling for is for the UK government to actually get its commitment to intangible heritage clear and to ratify the convention. But maybe it's because we ourselves are not very good in this country about thinking about intangible heritage. Perhaps, arguably, even the success of the National Trust of England, Wales and Northern Ireland has encouraged us to focus so much on the tangible heritage that we've kind of forgotten about the intangible. And we've tended to use heritage simply when we're talking about the tangible heritage. In fact, even worse, possibly we think that intangible heritage is something that happens elsewhere and it belongs to other countries and somehow isn't familiar to us in a UK context. But nothing really could be further from the truth. Here's a fantastic example of intangible cultural heritage. This is just down the road from where I live at home. This is cheese rolling at Cooper's Hill in Gloucestershire, where you wouldn't believe it really, but cheeses are rolled down the hill and people chase very dramatically, as you can see there, to capture and stop these cheeses before they get to the bottom of the hill. And there are many, many, many traditions like that in England, but we kind of don't think about them in any serious way. But honestly, whether we're talking about country houses, industrial sites, or archaeological ruins, all of these places are full of intangible heritage as well as tangible. Stories, music, dance, craft, all of these things belong in places, and those things are passed down through the generations. It's all, in fact, about identity and values and a sense of place. Now, the UNESCO Convention has got a very strict definition. It's one of those UNESCO-wordy things. So I'm going to read it out, but it just reminds us that this has been something deeply thought about at an international level. It says intangible cultural heritage is the practices, representations, expressions, knowledge, skills, as well as the instruments, objects, artifacts, and cultural spaces associated therewith that communities, groups, and in some cases individuals, recognise as part of their cultural heritage. This intangible cultural heritage, transmitted from generation to generation, is constantly recreated by communities and groups in response to their environment, their interaction with nature and their history. And it provides them with a sense of identity and continuity, thus promoting respect for cultural diversity and human creativity. So I think that gives a sense of the scope of what is embraced by this definition. So let's look at some examples. All of these are examples from members of INTU. First of all, let's go to India, where there's been real effort on the focus of intangible cultural heritage as a way of giving communities a real sense of purpose and direction and, frankly, an economic future by creating activity that generates income for these communities. This is the Indian Trust for Rural Heritage and Development, using unique cultural resources to provide something which is viable economically as well. So first of all, Nizamabad, which produces unique pottery. In fact, the clay mixed with goat droppings, which sounds very fragrant, to produce a very special kind of pottery, which is sold to tourists. And this is Mubarakpur, which makes luxurious handmade fabrics for saris and cloth, which again brings an income to the community. And this is Hariharpur, which has a unique music tradition. So this again is something that's been celebrated and now provides opportunities to create profitable heritage tourism products and businesses that benefit the local economy, improve living conditions for the community, and keep these traditions alive. It's a similar story in China, where the Beijing Cultural Heritage Protection Centre has been organising the women of Menglian County into a weaving cooperative. Now, this is producing woven goods using indigenous techniques and motifs adapted to the demands of the international market. So these are age-old techniques and products, but which are appealing to today's tourists and today's markets. And a project like this not only restores the pride of these groups in their ancestral traditions, but also tangibly helps them reduce poverty and inequality, since many of the jobs here are fulfilled by young people and by women, which is really unusual in most economic development projects. So this is a really profound way of helping the whole community to develop, good for the economy, good for social inclusion. And of course, can also be used by the authorities to foster respect for cultural and social diversity. It becomes a bonus to be doing something distinctive and original, to challenge prejudice and misrecognition. In New Zealand, the Maori Heritage Council has assisted the Board of Trustees of the Heritage New Zealand Pōhere Tanga, which are also members of INTU, in developing what they call a bicultural view, in recognising the importance of the Maori traditions. And so last month, Heritage New Zealand published Tapuwae, here, this magazine, which means sacred footprint, and is symbolic of the Maori heritage footprints in the landscape, things that you can't see unless you really work to understand, things that could be obliterated so easily. And to help people understand the vital importance of the Maori tradition in New Zealand's history. Now, of course, the Maori heritage comprises a huge range of different places and items, from the physical and tangible to the natural environment and the intangible social, spiritual, and ancestral traditions. And Tapuwae is a way of articulating a vision for protecting and celebrating these values. And in Canada, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission published 94 calls to action to redress the wrongs done to Indigenous peoples by the residential school system. There's been a huge political debate in Canada about these ancient wrongs that were done. And the National Trust Canada has stepped forward and hosted a series of roundtable gatherings, which have specifically brought together what they call the traditional knowledge keepers with the heritage advocates to talk cross-culturally about the vital importance of these very difficult experiences of the past. And what they've done is they've tried to bring a greater understanding of the Indigenous perspectives on traditional lands and sacred sites, and in the process have begun to build relationships and mutual understanding between communities today. In Kenya, the Trust for African Rock Art, which is called TARA, has been collaborating with the Abasuba Community Peace Museum. And this is just an example of the interpretation that goes with the rock art, identifying families and their relationship with the place that led to the rock art being developed. It's now, as a museum, promoting traditional methods of peace and conflict resolution. So recognising this was about more than art, but deeply about culture, about relationships, and around ancient family connections. But of course, we know there's another side to every story. Heritage can also be used by governments in less benign ways to try to shape public attitudes, in line with their own political agendas, or even to rally people against their neighbours in civil and international wars, in ethnic cleansing and genocide. There's been a huge, again, series of conflicts in which intangible heritage has either been used or abused to create new tensions. So I think we have to acknowledge here that there's a big relationship between intangible cultural heritage and human rights. And one of the messages in this complex world is how we can work to respect and accept the cultural identity of other groups, so that in a way respecting the human rights of each of these groups and the way the relationship between them, these arguments become so pertinent today amid all the debates about nativism, nationalism, populism, these things that are sweeping across the world, make us think very hard about how we can better respect difference and tradition as we try to move forward. So our conference in Entebbe in 2013 was really the first time I put into that we debated the whole issue of intangible heritage and passed a declaration conveying our conviction that intangible heritage is an important element of human rights, particularly with respect to minority people and the retention of local traditions. But of course, we also have to be careful that they don't infringe other human rights. There are many, many examples of ancient practices, for example, where society has moved on, and in many ways, rightly so. But of course, there are aspects of intangible heritage that we only just are having the courage to speak about. This is a year in the UK, for example, where we're celebrating 50 years since the partial decriminalisation of homosexuality, and the National Trust for England, Wales and Northern Ireland has taken what for many is a very important first step in celebrating that anniversary and in recognising the extraordinary way in which many National Trust places have stories around people of very different views and unconventional ideas of gender and sexuality, but have often those stories have been hidden. This has been a pop-up of recreation of the caravan type, which I know was in Soho, and I've got Joe at the back here, back in the 1930s, a place where people could come together of all different sexualities and different views, but which today the National Trust is helping to celebrate. So as part of its programme, it called Prejudice and Pride, which is a lovely title, really bringing out the enormous diversity of people in the National Trust movement who have brought some kind of rich and fascinating ideas to what is often in the past been told as a very straight story. So you see, what we think of as heritage today has not always been seen like that. Heritage and our understanding of it does change with the passage of time and through our appreciation and learning about different aspects of it. So finding new ways to address those multiple layers of meaning that our places and the intangible cultural expressions associated with them have acquired is a continuing and an evolving process. And it's not one that is just about the experts or the top-down professionals or government decisions. I think one of the things that we've learned at INTU is how vital it is to democratise the process of heritage understanding, to give a much larger role to local people in identifying what they think is important in their culture, in their experience, and give them a greater role in protection, safeguarding and decision-making as we go forward. Now, of course, the UNESCO Convention does give space to non-Western practices of heritage and has been of clear value to Asian, African and South American countries and indigenous heritage practice. In fact, arguably of more value there than it has yet in the developed world, which I think is one of the real challenges for us today. But clearly, we can't rely on international conventions to make things happen. We need to create a culture where our intangible heritage is valued for its own sake, and where we do give people that opportunity to take charge and to be involved. And there are some really positive signs of that happening. Every year in Australia since 1980, the National Trust of Australia has showcased heritage from all over the country in a big community-based festival of history and culture. And this year's festival starts today and includes a two-day event in Smithfield, New South Wales, celebrating Australia's multicultural communities through food, performance and discussion. Last year, about 1.2 million people attended one of those heritage festival events and shared hundreds of Australian stories of all kinds, reinforcing sort of multicultural and Indigenous heritage backgrounds. In fact, Australia is a place of really having to come to terms again with some very dark times in its past, and this is one of the ways that it's doing so. In Uganda, the Cross Cultural Foundation, our member, is working with healers and the Ministry of Health to develop a framework which would see traditional medicine and practice harnessed again, professionalised and turned into a useful and relevant product again today. Again, we've so often seen those kinds of practices marginalised as somehow, you know, not relevant to today's society. But this is a way of bringing economic and health benefits to a contemporary society and a restored sense of pride of those who have kept those memories and practices alive over generations. During the INTU conference in Entebbe, the delegates were given an experience of bark cloth making, where the inner bark of the mutaba tree, which is a kind of fig, is turned into cloth, and you can see an example there. Now, this is a practice from the Buganda Kingdom in southern Uganda, and it's now actually recognised by being inscribed on the representative list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity. So, how about that? But it can mean these things being given a value that reflects beyond their community. And our colleagues in Uganda are actually doing some great heritage education work and now run over 100 heritage clubs for young people, something I'm going to come back to before I finish. And they've gained huge inspiration for their education program from meeting representatives of other national trusts at the Entebbe conference, people from Indonesia, from INTAC, the Indian National Trust, and that experience of coming together, sharing good practice at the conference. Now, INTAC, which is the Indian National Trust for Art and Cultural Heritage, does work on a huge range of projects, restoration projects, but it also works in cities, working in partnership with municipalities on conservation projects, and also within those cities, running youth heritage clubs and guided heritage walks in cities. Now this actually is something that's becoming very big in Africa as well, this idea of helping people to experience a city through the eyes of a passion for heritage. It's one of the very, very first ways in which these new organisations are building support for heritage, incredibly important, particularly in cities where so much is swept aside in the name of progress. Now, this is Professor Menon, who's the convener of INTAC's Delhi chapter, and I met him in India when we established the International National Trust organisation in 2007. And he said, while many historic cities do not contain individual buildings of exemplary merit, they represent a way of life and living which is an intangible characteristic of urban heritage. And that's incredibly important because often people just look for the iconic building and say, that's doing heritage. But actually what he's saying is it's not just the historic fabric. In fact, it may not be the historic fabric at all which makes cities what they are. It's the living traditions, the markets, the restaurants, the entertainment, the way the past rolls forward into the present and into the future. Now, many of our National Trust members are keeping alive traditional skills associated with vernacular architecture. And here's an example in Slovakia, where the National Trust of Slovakia used a unique historic building in Bartošová Lehotka to teach thatching. Now, when they took on this project, very excited about reviving thatching, but you know what? There was nowhere to get the straw in Slovakia that they needed. Can you imagine a country like Slovakia, which would have lived through, you know, straw as one of its most important indigenous materials? They had to get the straw from Poland, to import it. So actually, what they did is they decided not only to rethatch the building, but to start growing and creating straw themselves. They persuaded a nearby landowner to give them some land so they could start to revive that growing of straw as well as the technique of thatching. So another example of how intangible heritage brings back things that would otherwise have been lost. And in Taiwan, volunteers here in the Taiwan Environmental Information Association are learning practical skills from a local indigenous tribe of the Pacilian region, the Atolan tribe, who have thousands of years of knowledge and no one apparently interested in passing it on to, until the Taiwan organization brought these volunteers together with the local population. Now, farming is often mistakenly perceived as a choice between tradition on the one hand and modern farming on the other. But actually, what we're learning through organisations like this is that most successful farmers in countries like Taiwan use the best available technology coupled with their ancestral knowledge, which they've accumulated incrementally and has been transmitted over generations and allows them a kind of shared experience of knowledge. Now that, in a way, is a really important message. It's not a choice of one or the other. You can actually bring the two together and give people a real sense of ownership of a new future where the intangible cultural heritage is a crucial part of what is going to be a success for the future. One of our member organisations in South Africa is called the Cape of Good Hope Living Heritage, and one of their annual events is a ritual reenactment of the 1795 entry of HMS Echo and the Battle of Hoot Bay, following which they have a cannon race with runners, surfers, skiers and swimmers who all race against each other, but apparently in such a way that they all have an equal chance of winning. I'm not quite sure how they manage that, but anyway. But this is the kind of historical enactment which again brings our history to life and gives them a sense of remembering these events of the past. But of course, although I said at the outset how vital it is that we all seek out these special places and special memories, there's also, isn't there, a risk of commercialisation and commodification of the tourist experience applied to intangible heritage? Do we risk sort of freezing or Disneyfying heritage through what some of the experts call folklorization, you know, turning into something so kitsch that it loses its authenticity? Simply calling it intangible heritage, are we destroying it by giving it a name? Are we actually, you know, part of the destruction of these important areas of historic memory, as well as the consumers of them? And tourism can certainly have a distorting effect as communities respond to meet tourist demands. Now, the Vera Marki, which is an annual community gathering in Guernsey, is something which has been run by the National Trust for Guernsey for over 40 years. And each year, about 6,000 people gather in Somerset Park to meet and greet and share and enjoy a whole range of Guernsey's favourite traditions, heritage and craft skills. This is a lovely way of keeping traditions going, celebrating, but also bringing new generations and a new spirit in. But that balance between enjoyment but commercialisation is one we have to keep a really careful eye on. Now in Grenada, the Grenada National Trust is encouraging sustainable heritage entrepreneurship through an endorsement scheme. So cultural practitioners who are recognised as having particular skills or bringing a kind of particular aspect of intangible heritage forward into the future are given access to the tourism market. So visitors know that this is an authentic and valued experience, that they're purchasing something which has come from an authentic background that embodies Grenada's tradition and culture, while actually having some kind of local approval, if you like, for authenticity and sustainability. This is a folk dancer supported by the scheme. So again, you can see how the benefits of tourism for cultural heritage are clear, but where we have to just keep an eye not to lose those special qualities which could just turn it into something completely commodified and losing its character. So ICOMOS's theme for World Heritage Day this year is in fact cultural heritage and sustainable tourism, chosen because this is 2017, is the UN Year of Sustainable Tourism for Development. So I think, you know, it's very clear that people are on to this message that tourism is actually a way of keeping intangible cultural heritage alive, can actually sustain in a really mutual beneficial way these traditions and the kind of memories that are so valued by communities. And perhaps in a world beset by insecurity and even fear about the future, these things become even more important. But again, we have to be careful how we draw the line. But it's probably no surprise to hear that the current economic and political situation represents significant challenges to many, many countries. One example is the National Trust of Zimbabwe, which manages a number of natural heritage sites, a museum, and a flagship property, La Rochelle. Now, the building at La Rochelle, which I'm not sure we can see there, actually, but it was, might be seen as an unremarkable building, but it was the home of Sir Stephen and Lady Courthold, who, in a way, are the classic sort of establishment British figures in Africa, but actually were really important and unusual because they were specific, renowned liberals, specifically championing the rights of indigenous people. The first ZANU constitution was written at La Rochelle, and it is still, in spite of all the challenges that have been experienced in that country, a great place to meet and talk. And so ladies, here are some from the Mutari Anglican Church, come regularly for a braai, which is a traditional barbecue. So it's still serving that place as a place of dialogue and community opportunity. A final example is the Indonesian Heritage Trust, the BPPI, which runs an education program in cities which encourage young people to come forward to love and understand their heritage. Heritage like handmade batik, which again is on the intangible heritage list, gamelan music, puppets, and other traditional and contemporary crafts. And this year, our conference will be hosted in Bali, in Jinjar, by the Indonesian Heritage Trust this September. And this is a country which has a special word, sajina, to describe the weaving together of all heritages, tangible, built and natural, and intangible heritage. So perhaps it's no surprise that living tradition and intangible heritage are part of our conference programme. This harmonious relationship between nature and culture is seen as a legacy from our ancestors, and the Indonesian Heritage Trust believes that conservation should be part of daily life, not just for the tourists, but something that's embedded in the culture of a nation and all that it does. So for those of us who are going, it's going to be an absolute delight to see Bali's tangible and intangible heritage and to experience again a fantastic cultural exchange which will take place with the delegates from across the INTU family. It's not a competition, this world. Who can get on the list? Who can get, you know, the best prize, as it were, of having the most distinctive heritage? This is about being stronger together, working together to support our global community. So I hope it's clear from what I've been saying that the preservation of our cultural heritage has never been more important, nor has it ever been embraced with more energy than in today's uncertain times. You could argue that we stand at the brink of a major junction in the history of humanity. Are we going the direction of globalization, of kind of everybody experiencing the same culture and striving for the same material things? Or, you know, do we recognize the diversity of the world, special qualities of places that could be lost by the relentless consumer exploitation of the world's resources? But in this increasingly uncertain world, I am more than ever convinced that the hope for the future lies in the hands of our young people. And it's vital to me that we in INTU help them to embrace the future more positively and more confidently by sharing the strengths and the value of cultural identity. This year we adopted as one of our major projects, one which aims to encourage African youth to embrace their heritage. This is this marvellous heritage education project. Working with the Monuments and Relics Commission, the Cross Cultural Foundation of Uganda, and the Zimbabwe National Trust, The project aims to educate and enthuse young people in Sierra Leone, Uganda and Zimbabwe to learn about and appreciate their cultural backgrounds and those of their neighbours. The first stage of the project is about to begin. We had a fantastic fundraiser earlier this year. Each of our INTU members will organise a short filmmaking competition for students at their heritage clubs, the clubs I mentioned earlier. The young people will be encouraged to make video clips about their cultural heritage and share them with other clubs across the country, across the region, and indeed across the world. This is the kind of exchange that can help people learn about each other's cultures, about their own cultures, and help them to explore new ways of seeing and understanding the importance of their own history. Encouraging them to understand and preserve cultural identity is a way of stopping it from being hijacked, either stripped away or overcome by commercialisation, and indeed of preventing cultural identity being viewed through the prism of fake news peddlers. But it doesn't matter, you know, you don't have to be, you can be anywhere in the world, you don't have to be in a certain place to focus on young people. This is the Gelderland Trust in the Netherlands, who are also passionate about engaging young people. And they do it, we all do it, because young people give us hope. Because despite all the problems that we all see, young people view the world in a positive way. Where we saw walls, they see open vistas. Their optimism and their confidence is absolutely crucial to the future of our heritage. And we need the next generation to get involved and to become champions for it. Understanding their cultural heritage is vital. Giving them a sense of identity, helping to feel they belong, feel safe and feel proud in their heritage. So learning about our heritage is what helps us to better respect and tolerate each other. So in recognition of the role of young people and to celebrate the work of national trusts throughout the world, I'm launching today our new resource called Trust Kids, and who wouldn't trust kids today? Drawing on the experience of our INTU members, we've created a list of 25 things young people can do to explore, celebrate, preserve and share their cultural heritage. Everything from drawing their family tree, finding out how their town got its name, learning a traditional dance or eating a regional dish, discovering a local custom or interviewing an elder about community traditions. There are some samples of the list around in this little brochure, which we're going to distribute all over the world today to our member organisations. This is above all about keeping ideas alive. It's not just about things and places, it's about people and memory, about experiences, about doing things that make us aware and full of passion for our heritage. And I believe not only can we must trust kids to protect and preserve our heritage for future generations. In a world of increasing globalisation, intolerance, fake news, all the rest of it, if our children have a sense of their history, of the value of their history, of the passion for it, I think we can have more confidence in the future. It draws heavily, this programme, on fabulous work that's already been done in the heritage clubs that I've described in Africa and India. It's work that I know that our member organisations will be hugely excited about taking up, about disseminating throughout the world. I hope you'll take a sheet today with 25 ideas on it and share it, perhaps do it yourself, give it to your children, make everybody aware of this extraordinary opportunity. Because now is the time to embrace our intangible heritage. Now is the time to act. Now. And it's time to trust our kids with the most precious inheritance that we all care so much about and empower them to help shape a better future. Thank you very much.